Rusty Quill presents.
Hello, welcome to SBRR, a retrospective on Spirit Box Radio. I'll be going through the show part by part, thinking about the themes and my intentions as a writer. These retrospectives will include heavy spoilers for the show, so please go back and listen before you tune into them. Already caught up? Awesome. I'm Aira Major, creator of Spirit Box Radio. Welcome back to the show. Hello, hello, hello. This time we are going to be talking about the first 10 episodes of the second part of Spirit Box Radio Season 2, which will bring us all the way up to Episode 29, Vibe Check. This section of the show sees Sam begin to realise their power and also begin to doubt his own capacity to be the hero of this story. I don't think it necessarily comes from a place of assuming that heroism was ever possible, more that Sam didn't think they'd ever be in a position where anyone would expect them to be a hero. Now this situation is beginning to unfold in this way, Sam is certain he will fail to live up to the new expectations those around him seem to have for him.
You don't need to do this, you know, if you're not ready.
As stupid as it sounds, Oliver, I feel like I need to. Before, Spirit Box Radio's kept me going. The faithful listeners kept me going. They hear me, Oliver. I know this sounds stupid, but so many things about Arcanism seem to be about belief and intent.
It's an interesting section in terms of the changes and developments we see across the core cast of characters, which really kicks off here with the opening episode of Season 2, Part 2, which barely features Sam at all. Kitty and Oliver sit, holding vigil, over Sam's near-dead body. The episode opens with Anna showing up with a box of microphones in the hopes that this will stir Sam, representing a fairly significant character growth for her.
Any change?
Nothing. What's with the box? Are those earpieces?
Microphones.
Why?
In case it helps.
There's at least 100 in here, Anna.
It might help!
Jesus wept. Welcome back to bloody Spirit Box Radio, I guess.
She's accepting the arcane into her life, and even trying to help Sam in an arcane way by providing these tools which may potentially connect him to that power. It's a tremendous turnaround from her attitudes in Season 1, and sets her up in pretty good stead for what's about to happen to her in the wider plot.
You know, Kitty, you can talk to me about it, if you like.
Yeah, you know how ridiculous that sounds after you grilling my sister into not trusting you, right?
You can trust me to keep a secret. That's part of the issue, really.
I have no idea how Sam puts up with you. You're infuriating.
Kitty and Oliver have a lot to talk about here. Kitty is the first major arcana not to consent, even in a warped kind of way, to becoming caught in this not-death situation, because she was dead when Sam constructed her deal and resurrected her. Oliver has since regretted his deal and has come to resent his situation, and I think the opposite is true for Kitty. I think she's glad she's sort of alive, but I think shocked and horrified by what's been done to her. In contrast to Oliver, though, what we see is that she has a profound sense of freedom, which Oliver has never experienced whilst the man in the flat cap holds his deal. Here we also hear a discussion of why Sam hasn't taken Oliver's deal the way he took the Inconvenient Sins deals. If that idea occurred to him so quickly there, why hasn't it occurred to him with Oliver? Well, it probably has, Oliver suggests, but Sam wouldn't take that chance of tipping the scales in their relationship too sharply in his own favour. In part, it's because he doesn't want that power over Oliver, but also because I think he doesn't want that responsibility. It's a joint fear about thinking he has a limited capacity, and also in thinking it would be morally bad as an act.
Sam won't take you.
I think that's the centrality of it, yes.
Why? He's all over you.
That's why.
Yeah, that makes literally no sense.
You can't see how that might be a complicating factor. My partner being in control of the literal sustenance of my arcane existence.
This is very significant for Oliver. I think he understands Sam's position but feels rejected by it. And despite him saying otherwise, I think he's afraid of Sam as much as he's afraid of losing him. Sam's powers evolve and change and grow at an alarming rate, and as they do, Oliver's carefully constructed emotional walls are broken down. It's not just perceptiveness, it's a perceptiveness heightened by Sam's magical abilities, such as when he touches Oliver's scars and identifies that Oliver voluntarily keeps them all, keeping memories of his own suffering displayed on his skin. Sam touches the scars and sees not just what they are, but what their purpose is.
They're all deaths, aren't they? Your scars. killing blows.
You can feel them all.
The other major arcana, they don't have scars like these.
No.
You keep them. When your body renews, you keep them. By choice.
To remember.
Why do you keep trying to punish yourself, Oliver? What could you have done that could be this bad?
You know nothing about it.
This makes Oliver incredibly vulnerable. He no longer has control over which parts of his life he shares with Sam and what he tells him. He can't prepare himself or tell things how he wants them to be told, giving him an incredible lack of agency in the situation. Sam even overwhelms a part of Oliver's deal with the man in the flat cab, compelling him to speak in contradiction to it, which is draining enough for Sam at this point that he does end up falling asleep. Oliver is able to speak about things he's been told not to speak about, though, highlighting what he suggests to Kitty, which is that Sam's power defaults over the man in the flat caps in situations where he asserts himself. It's just that Sam doesn't often assert himself. This is all really cool, but I think, again, alarming for Oliver to realise that Sam does, in fact, outrank the man in the flat cap in a lot of ways.
I can't believe I told you that. I shouldn't have been able to tell you that. It was taboo. Do you realise what this means, Sam? Magpie. Oh, you're asleep.
At this part in the show, we also get the first instance of this line, which gets called back to right at the end of the show.
I am a monstrous thing, Samael. More monstrous still for loving you.
This is just one of those little flourishes I really love, and I'm so glad I put it in. There's a bunch of these things that I bring up and then call back to in a way that scratches an itch in my little writer brain. I love it.
What do you want? Have I stepped out of line again? I'm sorry. I'll try and be a good little progeny of the arcane and not stick my nose where it isn't wanted.
The timeline is shot, it's true. But we want you on board. You know that. It's just these things take time.
Scourge is back on his schedule, and he turns up here to tell Sam secrets about Oliver, which Oliver is unable to tell due to the terms of his deal, but also which I'm not sure he'd want Sam to know about, and if he did, he certainly wouldn't tell the story in the way Scourge does. This is, again, completely tipping the scales of balance in the relationship between Oliver and Sam, and taking that completely out of Oliver's ability to control. As discussed previously, the control of the flow of information is very central to this story's plot. It's actually a really useful way to think about storytelling in general. As a writer, it's my job to control the information about the world and the characters and make sure that you, the audience, know what you need to know to make sense of everything, and to withhold things until they will have the maximum impact. In terms of the interpersonal relationships between the characters, who knows what and how they find out is really indicative of who is in power in what situation. What's interesting at this point in the story is that we see so much informational exchange happening between Sam and Oliver, about Oliver, but without Oliver's consent. This is also helpful to thinking about the man in the flat cap. The idea that the man in the flat cap is trying to control what everyone knows is one of the metatextual elements of this story. The man in the flat cap can't ever really be in charge of this because he's not the writer of the story, he's a character within it. Later, when we get to the ways that the man in the flat cap's ideology is flawed, this is kind of what I'm gesturing to. There is no reality beyond the story for him. He's only ever a character within this narrative. In the show, of course, I'm also talking about how reality itself has limitations, and we do ourselves a disservice if we act like we're in a rehearsal, when this is actually the only performance we'll get to have in these parts. Sam, though, is the narrator of the show, and so he gets to give voice to different story elements, and so is the medium through which the story gets its structure. Just in terms of how the story is put together, Sam has so much more power than the man in the flat cap ever could. This makes it extra fun that it's me who writes the show, who also plays Sam, because of course I really am in charge of the story in a way that the man in the flat cap can never be because he's a character that I made up. Just as Sam is only a little bit of the concept that he represents in the show's world, he's also a little bit of me, so of course his power is always going to trump the man in the flat caps. What's fun about the interaction that Sam has with Scourge about Oliver, though, is that the place he gives the most away is at the end, where Sam says it doesn't matter if Scourge has never been alive.
There is a gulf between knowing and understanding, and it cannot be resolved by knowledge alone.
One day, I'm going to kill you.
That's nice. Only, I've never actually been alive.
That doesn't matter.
Now you're getting somewhere.
Here, Scourge is referencing Sam's connection to that wider authorial power which he won't come to use until far, far later in the show, which is pretty cool. What's fun to mention in contrast to this is that this is the point in the show where Sam begins to very deliberately and purposefully withhold knowledge from the faithful listeners. He doesn't tell them that Kitty is a major arcana, even though he knows this to be the case. He doesn't discuss it. It's also possible he remembers more about what happened with Kitty than he's willing to disclose. In a way, this is a sort of healthy development for Sam. In season one, he's almost vomiting his private life across the airwaves. He can't help himself. It's the first connection he's ever having, and he can't stop himself from oversharing at every possible junction. In a way then, Sam choosing to keep some things back might represent a healthier mindset and an attempt to construct boundaries, but is also concerning because of which things he's choosing to keep back. Withholding Kitty being a major arcana is pretty significant because what Sam is obscuring here is a self-perceived fault. He thinks he's done something wrong and bad here, and it's his instinct to hide it. This does not bode well. It implies that in Sam's mind, when things go wrong, it's his burden and his alone, and he's the one that ought to fix it, and he should hide that it ever went wrong. This becomes increasingly dominant in Sam's perspective as the story progresses. This concept that the responsibility for things going wrong is his to bear and his alone, and therefore it's entirely on him to fix things. His increasing power represents to him, more than anything, an increasing amount of duty to fix everything. Again, like I mentioned a couple of episodes back, it's coming around to this idea of Sam as a people pleaser, obsessively attempting to anticipate the needs of those around him to an incredibly unhealthy extent. Except Sam has the immense power to enact every single crazy thing he thinks the people he loves might possibly want, whether or not his ideas about that have any connection to reality. Speaking of connections to reality, this section is a great place to stop and talk about the impossible children and what things from my own life I'm drawing on when I'm writing them and coming up with a concept of them. I remember when I was younger thinking that there was a particular horror to the story of Peter Pan. When I was a kid, I was very desperate to be a grown-up. My parents say they can trace this desire back to me being about 2 years old. My mother and I were having beans on toast for dinner, but my dad came in with chips from the chip shop just for himself. I said to my mum that it wasn't fair because we were all supposed to have beans on toast for tea. My mum said it didn't matter because my dad is a grown-up and he can do what he likes. Apparently, my eyes went as wide as the plate my beans and toast were on, and from that day on, I seemed eternally pissed that I was still, unfortunately, a child. Experience-wise, I remember being very frustrated at my lack of ability to assert my autonomy. I didn't like being told what to do or where to go. This really built itself into a strong rebellious streak when I was a teenager, but generally speaking, it just made me very angry. Of course, to me, the idea of Peter Pan, this eternal child, was horrifying. It made me furious that he tried to convince Wendy to stay with him in Neverland, and it was the only fairy story which presented its protagonists with a choice to return to reality or not, where I remained thoroughly on the side that the darling children should absolutely go back to the real world. There was no other story where I thought that that should happen. I actually really hate this as a thing, that at the end of these fairy stories, the children go back to normality. When I was a kid, I was like, why would you do that? That's an idiotic choice. But in Peter Pan, I was like, no, leave Neverland. It's horrifying. There's a lot of work and responsibility that comes with being an adult, but the trade-off for being able to self-determine always seemed worth it to me. It also didn't matter to me that the darling children and Peter Pan could do whatever they liked in Neverland. A key part of my want to be a grown-up was that I wanted other people to take me seriously and to respect my autonomy and self. And despite Peter Pan's accomplishments and his clear ability to hold his own in a fight against Captain Hook, the adults in Neverland never take him seriously, precisely because he's a child. He is consistently underestimated and not respected, and I hated that for him. It was just appalling to me as a concept. Anyway, this has been very lengthy and perhaps shows you too much about my personal life and the way that my mind works, but I do think it's important to understand where I'm coming from when I'm writing The Impossible Children. To me, they are trapped in a horror scenario. Maria Gillespie's situation is horrifying to me not just because she's an eternal child kept in a room away from others and trapped there presumably forever. The horror, for me, isn't really in the trapping part. It's in the not growing up. It's not that kids are freaky, though they can be. It's that the experience of that, of being stuck in one's childhood, it horrifies and upsets me on a really deep and visceral level.
Why are you thanking me?
For showing me this?
No, don't you understand? The interpretation of this prophecy that the Scaresmongers are running with is that they need to consume the flesh of the heir apparent in order to become one with the One. That's what the redistribution is. Don't you get it? They're going to eat you.
No, they aren't.
J. Magnum, which is the universe's silliest Jonah Magnus spoof name I could think of. Also, little side note to this is that all of Jay's friends, none of whom speak, are named a variation of the name Michael. I'm being such a little shit with this, but it's not super important. I just felt the need to point it out. Anyway, Jay Magnum has this comprehensive collection of information about the Impossible Children, prophecies and the Man in the Flat Cap and Sam and the Harbingers. And so these things all get linked up very conclusively in this way here. And we also get to see testimonials from different scaremongers too, which I personally find very fun.
Hi, my name is Maria Gillespie. Here's a copy of today's paper. I'm 104 years old. For most of that time, I believed I would never grow up, frozen forever at 7 or 8. But then I met B, and he taught me the way of scarcity, and gave me the sacrament. Now I'm fully grown, though I may not take the sacrament again. I don't want to get wrinkles.
Maria Gillespie is both involved in the scaremongers and is formerly an impossible child. I don't know why, but I find it satisfying that the only way that the impossible children can grow up is by consuming other people. Children who aren't properly nurtured don't usually actually grow up to be cannibals, but I think the metaphor works quite well here. It's interesting that Maria finds her support from a cult. Like Arlo, she wants to be loved and accepted, and the cult is able to exploit her because of that.
All of those people, they trusted B, and he fails them. That makes me so, so angry.
This brings us quite nicely back to Sam's sense of responsibility. We see a more positive aspect of this when he discusses his views of B and the behaviour of the scaremongers. B is a sort of foil for Sam, someone drawing people close to him with the promise of connection, only B's promise is false. Sam is rightly furious at what they perceive to be a gross manipulation of people, luring them close and then tricking them into volunteering themselves to be eaten. Sam finds this utterly abhorrent, and I think they're right to do so. I think it also points to the ways in which Sam might be pretty decent at being in charge, were they to give themselves a real chance at doing so without letting guilt consume them. The trouble is that all of Sam's role models for power and authority have all completely stripped those they have power over of any agency and freedom. I think in Sam's head, the only way to have authority is to take away people's agency, but to do so whilst trying your best to please them. Of course, this is a terrible approach, but there are moments where you can see that Sam could be capable of being a kind and thoughtful leader if he wasn't thinking about things in this sort of warped way. Circumstances just mean that they aren't often able to explore or demonstrate that.
Hello, you.
Why are you still even here?
Do you see me? Do you see me looking at you?
I...
Do you see it?
Yes.
I see you. I know you. I love you.
Sam.
You are not a monster.
Sam's profound kindness after Oliver murders Jay is another moment where we see this capacity for good, careful leadership. It's a complex moment for reasons previously discussed, because of the practical and emotional push and pull around whether or not Sam ought to take Oliver's deal.
Look with more than your eyes.
What on earth are you talking about?
Anna, I am deadly serious. Please listen to me. Guy is not who you think he is. Anna.
Oh no.
Another big moment in these episodes I would be remiss not to mention is the reveal that Anna's fiancé is a fake. This is extraordinarily horrifying for a multitude of reasons. And it's interesting because I think up until this point, Anna doesn't perceive herself as being particularly necessary in all of this. She has a separate life, and indeed makes reference several times to wanting to keep her family stuff away from her life as a lawyer and partner to Guy. It's sad to hear her realise that, through Guy, the Man in the Flat Cap has built artificial distance between Anna and her siblings, where there was already tension and complicated feelings. Her future unravels, and with it, her sense that she is, or ever really has been, in control of the trajectory of her own life. I think to Anna, this will look like another moment her mother is failing her, even though Madame Marie has been dead well over a year at this point. The ways that Anna is continually failed by Madame Marie are shocking and multitudinous.
What do you mean you're not surprised?
I mean, well, it makes sense, doesn't it?
Does it? Oh, well, I suppose that's just fine then.
Sam, please stop shouting. We have neighbours.
Sorry.
This section of episodes ends with a conversation between Sam, Anna, and Beth. The fact this conversation happens at all feels impossible compared to the first instance where Beth and Anna speak in season one, where Anna tells Beth to go away and tries to get Sam to stop broadcasting. Here, though, Anna engages in conversation with Beth, a ghost, acknowledging her for what she is, an arcane thing, and accepting her as that. The content of Sam and Beth's conversation is deeply important. It looks at the function of arcane spaces and hints at what Sam himself is. Sam is haunted by his past, which is represented by his childhood home, and at the same time, he is those things. The house haunts him, and he is the haunted house. These things are not separate. In this conversation, Beth also points out to Sam the massive shift change that raising Kitty from the dead has caused.
It was big, I think, but I don't really understand why it was so big.
I mean, raising people from the dead isn't possible, so I'd say it's pretty huge just on its own.
Yeah, I know. But, I mean, like, for you, for everyone in the forums, did it change you?
Yes, I think so. I mean, look at me. You can look at me.
It's wild. I am observing.
You sure are. And I'd say that's pretty significant, wouldn't you?
Yeah, pretty significant.
Beth is almost corporeal now and has more agency than ever. When I was recording these episodes, Daisy, my sister and Beth's voice actor, commented how in every conversation that Beth has, she seems to become more and more herself, and that's a deliberate move on my part as the writer. Even though Sam has all of these internal doubts, as his power grows, he doesn't just suck energy from those people who are bound to him, like Beth, he also gives power to them, allowing them to have more substance, more freedom, more power of their own, even if he doesn't realise that's what he's doing. When Sam looks in the mirror, he sees himself as a void at first, but when he looks closer, within the dark space there are thousands of twinkling stars representing his connections to other people. Sam is made up of those connections, those bonds. Unlike descriptions of the arcane around the man in the flat cap we see later, which describe a spiderweb of complex interlocking knots, this depiction of Sam's relationship as stars, which are distinct celestial bodies, each shining independently, is pretty important for understanding how they are the same, but also fundamentally different from one another. Sam and his followers are connected like constellations are connected. When you look at the sky and you see the Big Dipper, it's not literally connected by dotted lines. It's connected by the stories that we tell about those stars. It's fitting, then, that the episode where that description happens ends with two people important to Sam, Anna and Beth, bonding with each other, both with Sam and independently from him. Right then, and with that, I am done. Take care of yourselves, folks. You deserve it. Until we speak again, remember to stay spooky.
Spooky.
Hi, I'm Aira, creator of Clockwork Bird and Spirit Box Radio, and I'm here to tell you about my other show, Not Quite Dead. After seeing a succession of patients succumb to the same brutal injuries to their necks, Alfie, an overworked emergency nurse, is almost killed by a foul, rotting creature. He's saved by a mysterious man who tells him the only chance Alfie has to live is to let him drink his blood. Alfie agrees, not realising that giving his blood to Casper, a vampire, will mean the two of them are inextricably linked. This strange bond pulls Alfie deep into the world of vampires, and soon he is faced with a terrible choice. Walk away and forget, or risk it all and try to become a vampire himself. Not Quite Dead is a gory romance horror story about the violence of vulnerability and the horrors both outside and within ourselves. If you like vampire stories, twisted romance, gory horror, and stories which bite back, search for Not Quite Dead wherever you find your podcasts, or go to hangingsawstudios.com/not-quite-dead to find out more.